So this course is going to be about twister theory. And twister theory is a way to relate complex geometry to certain PDEs that appear naturally in physics. Such as the Einstein equation, the Yang-Wells equation, and so on. So before I get to talking about the twister correspondence, I'm going to have to spend at least some time explaining a bit about complex geometry. So the first couple of lectures will be, I'll be talking about what is a complex manifold. What kind of tensors one can have in a complex manifold. So it's going to take me a little while to do that before we get on to discuss the twister correspondence. So I'm going to start with the very simplest of complex manifolds. If I take an open subset of Cn, and I take some function u to c, we say f is holomorphic if it satisfies the Cauchy-Riemann equation. Df dz bar I is equal to 0 for I equals 1 n, up to n. So I'm sure you guys have seen the Cauchy-Riemann equation for one complex variable before. This is just the same, except I ask that it holds for all of the coordinates. So you can rewrite it in terms of real coordinates. If I take xi to be the real part of zi, and yi to be the imaginary part of zi, then the Cauchy-Riemann equation df dxi, let's call this, say, j, plus I times df dyj equals 0. And of course, we can rewrite this further. So f is a function valued in the complex line. So the real and imaginary parts of f are real functions. So you can simplify it further in terms of so once you write it like this, it's, you know, a system of 2n partial differential equations on two functions, the real and imaginary parts of f. So this, I'm writing this out just to make it extremely concrete. So the following definition, a complex manifold of complex dimension n is a manifold of real dimension 2n with local coordinates z1 up to zn, which are valued in the complex numbers. So on each coordinate patch, instead of giving 2n real functions to specify my point, I'm going to give n complex functions. But the key relation is when I go from one coordinate patch to another, the transition function is holomorphic, such that if u, v are coordinate patches, with zi are the coordinates on u, then wi as a function of z is a holomorphic function of the zi. So being holomorphic means, we look at the equation for holomorphic. F only depends on z and not on z bar. That's how we should think of it. So being a complex manifold means when I change coordinates, the new coordinates are just functions of z and not of z bar. OK, any questions about this definition?
Yeah? Is it similar to the definition of diffeomorphism for real manifolds?
Yes, in that if I have a real manifold is defined so that when I go from one coordinate to another, the operator which changes coordinates is a diffeomorphism. So it's similar. So let's start with some examples. So in this class, we're actually not, the theory of complex manifolds is quite involved. They can be quite complicated. We're not really going to go very deep into it. So we're going to be talking about relatively simple complex manifolds. So the first example we're going to consider is CP1, which is S2. It's also called the Riemann sphere. By the way, there was some discussion of string theory in the QFT3 course, right? And did people talk about complex structures and Riemann surfaces a little?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you've seen this kind of thing before to some degree? Well, okay, I'll repeat it a little bit, but maybe I'll go a bit faster. So how do we make S2 into a complex manifold? Well, I'll draw this picture rather badly. So S2 minus the north pole is equal to R2, or the complex plane by stereographic projection. So what's stereographic projection? I take a point, take a point and I draw a line through the North Pole until I hit the plane. That's the map. Since P to phi of P, which is the point on the plane, which is on the line through P and N. So this way, the two sphere minus the North Pole is equal to the complex line, and I'll give it with coordinate z. So in the same way, the two sphere minus the South Pole is also equal to the complex line with coordinate w. So by stereographic projection from the South Pole. So we've covered the two-sphere by two opens. I'll say u is the two-sphere minus n, v is the two-sphere minus the South Pole. So on U intersection V, we have coordinates W and Z, and that you can check that W is 1 over Z. All right, so we've glued together these two patches, and the coordinate transformation is W equals 1 over Z. Since evidently this does not depend on z bar, we have a complex manifold. So S2, also called CP1, is a complex manifold.
What do we do with the points z equals 0 or w equals 0?
Well, the coordinate transformation. So I take the z plane minus the origin is equal to the w plane minus the origin by the transformation w is 1 over z. So the locus where z is 0, that is just not represented by the w-coordinate. The w-coordinate misses that point because z is 0. Z is 0 is down here, right? This point will get mapped to 0. And that's exactly where the w-coordinate is not defined. And conversely, when w is 0, that's when z is infinity. So I only glue together the patch when they're both non-zero.
have a very silly question. Normally, we say that the sphere is like the plane and you add a point, but here we are taking off a point.
Well, we take off. We're saying the plane is the sphere with the point taken off, right? The plane is the sphere with the north pole removed. So conversely, the whole sphere is the plane with the point added in. Yeah. Like, if you look at this picture, I was thinking, or if this point here went towards the north pole, then the point on the plane would kind of head off towards infinity. So that's why the north pole corresponds to infinity on the plane.
On the first line, when you say CP2 is...
CP1.
CP1, sorry, yeah. CP1 is S2.
Yeah, it's just another name for the same thing. People.
But do we always mean that... This is something that always confuses me. Is there always the action of Z2? Because for CP0, it's S1, but then you have to identify...
Oh, no, that's ORP. You're getting confused between real and complex projective spaces. So... Or P1 is S1 with the two points, opposite points identified. So the complex projective spaces are different. So just I'll spend a minute explaining the way these work, which will help your confusion. What CPN is the collection of vectors Z1 or Z0 up to Zn, where we identify a vector like this is equal to lambda Z0 to lambda Zn for lambda in the complex line, not zero. And this vector, not all zi are zero. So this can't be the zero vector. So in the complex projective spaces, we identify two vectors when they differ by multiplying by a scalar. And you were talking with the Z mod 2 action. That's because sending something to minus itself is a natural scalar in the real numbers. But here it's more about, you know, the unit real numbers are 1 and minus 1. But the unit complex numbers are the circle. So this can also be viewed as the 2n minus 1 sphere of the vectors of length 1 divided by the circle. I don't know if that helps, but we can.
Is there any way to see how, like, in CP1, for example, we can think of lines in C2, which mm-hmm. are identified with
yes.
rescaling?
Yes.
How that is topologically equal to S2?
Yeah, OK. So what he just said is that CP1 is equal to the collection of straight lines, complex lines, through 0. So the connection from here to here is that if I have a vector, I can look at the line it spans. If I scale my vector, that line doesn't change. So the information of a vector up to scaling is the same information as of this line. So why is this the same thing as this description? Well, there's a patch. We look at the patch. Where it can be represented by a vector whose second component is 1. So this is the patch, if I were to draw it on the plane, this is the patch of lines which are not vertical, right? Because if I take a generic line, projects onto the second coordinate in a non-zero way. Let's call this patch U. There's also V, a patch where we represented by 1W. Now, any line lives in one patch or the other, because if you take any line, it either projects isomorphically onto the horizontal or it projects isomorphically onto the vertical. And then on the intersection, well, Z1 is equivalent to 1 over Z, because I can rescale my vector. So the coordinate transformation is W is 1 over Z. It's the same as we saw before. Does that answer your question?
What is the colon notation?
Oh, the colon notation is it's a notation people use instead of a comma to remind you that this vector should be taken up to multiplying by a scalar. That's a kind of standard notation.
That formula of CPN you wrote down, which is equivalent to S to M minus 1 mod S1, if N is 1, that's S1 mod S1.
Sorry.
If N is 1, that would be S3 mod S1. If
yes.
N is S2.
Yes, that's the hop, called the hop vibration. So if N is 1, if I take S3 is the set of vectors like Z1, say ZW, where Z bar plus WW bar equals 1. That's just, you know, the usual sphere. But CP1 is equal to the set of ZW in S3. But then I must say, you know, when are these two vectors related by scalar multiplication? Well, I can't change the like length of the vector. I can just rotate it. So where lambda bar is equal to 1. So I make, say, two vectors are the same if they're related by multiplying by a complex number of length 1. That's the group U1. Now, if you like, you can say, I've written down an action of the group U1 on the unit 3 sphere, and we've just checked that it is the orbit space is the 2 sphere. And you can rewrite it in real coordinates if you like. This is a U1 which lives inside of SO4. Okay, so that was a bit of an aside. Not that one. We actually already know enough to explain what twister space is. So twister space is the complex manifold which has two coordinate patches. U and V, where U is equal to C3 with coordinates V1, V2, and Z, and W is also equal to C3. The coordinates are V1 tilde, V2 tilde, and Z tilde. So the intersection U intersection V is the locus where Z is not equal to 0, and Z tilde is also not equal to 0. And the coordinates are identified Z tilde is 1 over Z, and VI tilde in this simple way. So I take two patches, and I identify one patch with the other by, in this way, Z tilde is 1 over Z. So the region parameter is by Z tilde, by Z and Z tilde, that's a copy of CP1. And over here, I have two copies. I have a copy of C2 living above it. So we'll say more about this later, but I just wanted to write it down. So when we do the twister correspondence, we're going to have to talk about tensors on complex manifolds. See, you guys all know about tensors and real manifolds. They can be covariant and contravariant and so on. So there's a similar story on complex manifolds. So if Zi are local coordinates, then you know the analog. Like a one form is a field of covectors. So one form is a called a 1-0 form. It is an expression like F, by using upper or lower indices, F I D Z I. So just the same as we would have in ordinary geometry, except instead of DXs, I'm writing DZs. So a 1-0 vector, I'll often omit the 1-0 when it's not ambiguous. So it's an expression like fi d by dci. So tensor fields can be described in the same way as expressions with, you know, multiple DZs or multiple D by DZs or both, just exactly as in ordinary geometry. So the new thing is that it makes sense to ask that these expressions are holomorphic. So we know what a holomorphic function is. We can also talk about holomorphic tensors. Although I realize before we get there, I have to remind you how we go from one coordinate patch to another. So if Wy are new coordinates, then the Jacobian is, of course, this, the usual Jacobian. Now, it doesn't have any z bars, because W does not depend on z bar. And then, you know, Fi dWi is equal to but the usual way, or, you know, dWi is just the usual expression we're all familiar with. We just drop any z bars. And similarly, for the vector, you know, d by dWi is given by the inverse of the Jacobian matrix. In the usual way. So we'll do some computations in a sec, but are there any questions about this? It was all very elementary.
What about 0, 1 vectors?
Yeah, I wanted to introduce those later. 0, 1 vectors will be things that look like d by dz bar. And or here, they look like dz bar. Okay, so for example, let's consider CP1 with two patches. The coordinates on the patches. And W is 1 over Z. So how do we... how do these guys transform? Well, dw is minus c minus 2 dz dz. dw d by dw minus c squared d by dz and d by dz. D by dw. Let's think about why this has to be true. This is my Riemann sphere. This is the point z equals infinity, or w equals 0. Now, consider the vector field. The vector field d by dz it's generically non-zero. It moves you around. But it fixes infinity, right? Because if I translate everything in the plane, infinity doesn't move. So it's clear that this vector field has to vanish near infinity, which it does. Similarly, z del z is minus w del w. What does this mean? Z del z is a rotation around this. Z del z is a rotation around the south pole. This is a rotation around the north pole, and we see that they're opposite to each other, which again is clear geometrically.
Sorry, Kevin. Mm-hmm. Could you explain to me why z dz is a rotation like that? From the point of view of the plane, it's like dilation.
Well, it's a combination of both of them, right? If you look at the real and imaginary parts, it's how does it work? It's going to be something like the real part is or del or, and the imaginary part is del theta. So if you look at the imaginary part as a rotation, and the real part is goes up like that. But again, here the real part pushes you away from zero and brings you towards infinity, which is why there's a sign change. Okay, so we've talked about how tensors transform, but I mentioned that it makes sense to talk about a tensor field being holomorphic. Like, say, Fi dzi is holomorphic if in each coordinate patch Fi are holomorphic. So this is a reasonable thing to ask for, because when I go from one patch to another, the Jacobian factor is holomorphic, so this property will be retained. So so we can ask the following, questions. Like, what kind of holomorphic tensors do I have on all of CP1? So are there any holomorphic one-forms? So if there was such a thing on the Z patch, it would be something like F of Z dz. On the W patch, it will be G of W dw. And they must agree. So that F of Z is equal to, dW is minus Z minus 2. They must have this equation. So W is 1 over Z. So what does this tell us? This tells us that as z goes to infinity, f of z goes to 0 like z to the minus 2. because G is regular. So if we had a holomorphic one form on CP1, it would be some function, f of z, some holomorphic function, which decays really fast. Well, decays at some rate at infinity. So do you guys remember the maximum principle from undergraduate analysis? Or, well, the maximum principle tells you that if you have a holomorphic function, which is everywhere bounded, then it's constant. So, f holomorphic is bounded in C, then it is constant. So here f is bounded, and it goes to 0 at z equals infinity. So therefore, f must be 0. If it was some constant, it would have to be 0. Okay? So there are no holomorphic one-forms in CP1. So this type of argument, I think we'll be using a fair bit, but I think it's a useful thing to understand. Any questions about it? Yeah?
Can you explain again the previous part of the argument, like what happens when z goes to infinity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when, draw a little picture. Here is z equals infinity, w equals 0. When z goes to infinity, then I'm on this patch with coordinate w. And there, f is just g. Well, so this can be written as minus w squared g of w. So on this patch, we already know we had a well-defined one form in this patch. So it can't have any poles. And it because of this factor of minus w squared, it must vanish at w equals 0. I could have done the argument the other way around, involving g, of course, but. Yeah.
And is it the same case for anti-holomorphic forms as well?
Yes. So if you wanted to do anti-holomorphic forms, you would have to say, it looks like dz bar. But it wouldn't really make sense to have a function here which is holomorphic, because the Jacobian factor for dz bar is an anti-holomorphic function. It satisfies the opposite of the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So this should be anti-holomorphic f of z bar. And then it would just be the same, but the complex conjugate.
Maybe a quick remark about this?
Yeah.
I remember hearing recently at some point that when one studies functions over projective spaces, somehow that's akin to studying functions over Cn with appropriate boundary conditions. So this would be the procedure to
But homogeneity, so.
Huh?
Appropriate homogeneity. So they have. Yeah, maybe that's something we can go through at some point. So you might ask, you know, CP1 is like this quotient of C2, right? Take two vectors and identify them up to scale.
Yeah.
So you can think, like, from that picture, how do I think about a one-form? And then there's a way of thinking, saying, well, a one-form is going to be a holomorphic function on C2 with some weight under scaling. And you'll end up at the same answer.
Yeah. Okay, that way I was more aware of, but here it seemed like we declared some f of z, and f of this z lives on C.
Right, I'm just working on a patch.
Exactly, just on a patch.
Yeah.
And we said, in order for this to be an actual honest-to-God form on
CP,
actually, it must satisfy its patching condition.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, well, the only true one is the zero function, that therefore...
Mm-hmm.
But, well, so in general, and it seems we imposed boundary condition. We said f of z has to go to zero as z goes to infinity. And so
yeah, but the boundary conditions just come from saying, you know, it must be a form on... I suppose this was a function inside of a form. To be a function on CP1, that means it must approach some value, constant value at infinity.
Okay.
So if it was, the argument would be the same, but then I would say f is bounded, so f must be a constant.
Okay.
Okay, so
I think the intuition somewhat holds that. It's about imposing appropriate boundary conditions in some, maybe.
Yeah, but you shouldn't think that I'm just making up the boundary conditions. The boundary conditions are just that it behaves well in the other patch.
Yes.
So, like, if I go to the other patch, the point I didn't have, which is infinity here, and now I have, and I can study its behavior there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is f bounded? Could we say that there's a pole at z equals zero?
When we say holomorphic, I say I don't want to allow any poles. So holomorphic means it's a function on, say, f is a holomorphic function on C without any poles. So that can't be a pole at zero. So the word for a function which can have a pole is meromorphic.
Right.
So what about vector fields? Let's study the same argument. Suppose f of z del z and g of w del w, so this pair, define a holomorphic vector field in CP1. What are the constraints? Well, we just do the same thing. We find that f of z is equal to now minus z squared g of 1 over z, or if you prefer, minus 1 over w squared g of w. So because vectors transform in the opposite way, I get the opposite power. And that tells us that f is allowed to have a pole at infinity. So that f of z of z must be A del z plus b times z del z plus c times z squared. So there's three functions which have a pole of order 2 at infinity, 1, z, and z squared, and I'm allowed to have those. Okay, does anybody recognize these vector fields?
Translation.
Yeah, this is the conformal algebra. These are rather more precisely they're real and imaginary parts. So normally you would say, well, there's six conformal transformations of the plane, two translations, dilation, rotation, and two special conformal transformations. And the two translations are real imaginary part of here, dilation and rotation are the real and imaginary part of this, and the special conformal transformations are the real imaginary part of this. Yeah?
Is the reason that we allow vector fields with poles order less than two is by saying g of omega can regularize the
poles? Yeah, so let's see. FC. I'm saying this very badly. So I take FC DZ, and when I translate it to the other patch, it becomes W squared. So in the other patch, it looks like this. Because G is minus W squared F, and the other patch is going to look like this one. So then I say, when Z is infinity, so when W is 0, it must be regular. Well, it's regular as long as F is a pole of order most 2. At that point. Not going as fast as I had first thought, but that's totally fine. So here, I want to state a fact. I'm not sure we're going to be able to prove the whole thing. So this is going to be maybe the very first connection between twister space and space-time. So here we saw the holomorphic vector fields in CP1 are some version of the conformal transformations of OR2. But on twister space, we see something similar. The holomorphic vector fields on twister space are equal to the conformal transformations, the conformal vector fields on, say, OR4, but with complex coefficients. So I think I'll spend a few minutes trying to go through as much of this as we can. And I hope it'll be kind of suggestive. The first thing we need to understand, though, is what are these conformal vector fields? Does anybody know the dimension?
It's a d plus 1, d plus 2.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's 15. Yeah, so this is a 15-dimensional algebra. So what is this? It consists of four translations, rotations and one dilation and four special conformal transformations. So we're going to be able to find them by using the following rules. All right, is it?
Like from this, it seems that twisters are vector representations of the conformal group, but I like they are supposed to be spinners of SO2, 4, but these are 15 vector representations. So this is slightly confusing.
Right, I see your confusion. Right, so the there's a definition of twister space as, you know, it's an open subset of CP3. CP3 has symmetry group SL4, PSL4, which is the conformal group. But you want to say, you want to think of it as being the projectivization of the four-dimensional spin representation. I don't think there's a conflict because the projectivization means that the element of the center of spin 4 doesn't act on the projective space. So I think it's all fine. Well, I gotta stop in a sec, but so maybe I'll just say the rules are. So del Z, this is a 0 of order 2. VI, pole of order 1, del VI, 0 of order 1, and of course Z, pole order 1. So the game is you want to look at F del Z plus GI del VI, which have no poles at Z equals infinity. And if you spend a little bit of, you know, 10 minutes, you should see there's 15 of them. You know, I have the same thing here. I have del Z, Z del Z, Z squared del Z. I can multiply del Z by V, or by V squared, and so on. But yeah, maybe I'll pick it up there next time. And yeah.
How do you get, I think that you talked about this in your lecture, how do you get different signature instead of R4? Because this is Euclidean R4.
I should look at the vector fields with complex coefficients. And if I wanted Euclidean R4, I really should take real coefficients. If I wanted Lorentzian R4, I should take some other condition on my coefficients. So with the vector field with complex coefficients, these are really the symmetries of complexified spacetime. So no signature has been picked yet.